This used to drive bee researchers insane because they thought over the 20-odd million years that bees have been around, there would have evolved what one might call bee compliance officers.
Business planning is all predicated on the idea we can predict the future.
The book is called What to Do When You Don't Know What to Do, and it's on adaptive strategy, you know, sort of the current world of uncertainty.
From Orion X, this is the Marketing Podcast. Marketing has transformed in significant ways. More technology, more data, more social, more blending of arts and sciences, more integrated with every other function, and ultimately more critical to the organization. Join Shaheen Khan and Doug Garnett as they discuss news and happenings in the world of marketing, from the boardroom to customer programs.
Hi, everybody. Marketing Podcast here, episode number 41. And I'm here with Doug Garnett as usual. This is Shaheen Khan, and we have a very special guest, none other than JP Castlin. You should go to his website, jpcastlin.com. That's jpcastlin.com. JP, thanks for being here. How are you, Doug? Let's start.
I'm doing well. I've spent a week in paradise in Central Oregon, so
I feel
quite relaxed. We'll see. Yeah, I know it's been rough, but somebody had to do it, and so I took it upon myself.
And JP, you're in beautiful Sweden. Tell us.
First of all, thank you for having me. Beautiful Sweden is looking decent, but I won't be here for much longer. I'm in a very hectic traveling period of my life at the moment, but glad to be home for the time being anyway.
Excellent. So for everybody, you're a global name and you're your own brand and everybody knows you. But in case you don't, our audience, go check the website. JP started out as a corporate finance lawyer. Next thing, he's leading strategy for a lot of big brands around the world. Very well known. Always gets awards for his speeches and keynotes. He has a newsletter called Strategy in Praxis that you should go subscribe to, writes articles that are always very impactful, and also writing a book about adaptive strategy. We live in a very complex world. So maybe that would be our entree. Let's talk about complexity. Doug, you're writing a book about complexity, so you guys can definitely have a meeting of the minds there. But I also want to double click on the word praxis, because when you use strategy in praxis rather than in practice, you're not just looking for a harder word to say practice. So complexity, practice,
yeah, no.
Let's go.
All right. So typically the sort of the traditional dichotomy, if you will, is between theory and practice. We're all familiar with that. What praxis is, theory-informed practice. In other words, you start with a theory, you try it out in practice, then you learn, you change the theory, you adapt, and you sort of improve over time. And there are lots of benefits to this, because if you don't understand a theory, you won't be able to scale the practice, right? You just do stuff. And so praxis is, again, you start with a theory, and then the theory leads to all the practicalities and all the pragmatics, and then you learn and you adapt and you sort of evolve over time. That's the idea anyway.
Yeah, that's excellent. I always took it as like, how do you actually implement?
Yeah.
And you can't implement if you haven't practiced it, if you haven't understood it. It's like the next stage sort of a thing, right? Doug, what's your view on this and also complexity?
First of all, we should let the audience know that JP and I have conversations every few weeks, and we have both been working on our books in parallel. And JP's focus on strategy, I'm focused on a kind of a broader sense of like doing business with complexity in mind. And so that's always been really valuable. I think the praxis idea, yeah, it weaves more in, I suppose, to my mind, between kind of that theory and taking a serious look at how does it work into practice. There's a tendency among practitioners to say, I did this, it works, that's all that matters. But I think that we all need a bit bigger sense of it, which is, I did this, it works, how does that relate to theory? Should I be changing theory? Should I be adapting to theory? What should I be doing? And that's, I think, a lot of it. And I think what JP has done with it has been really beneficial for the world of strategy, especially getting away from the formality of strategy has been worked into this place where it's become dull. You know, I hear a lot of people talk about strategy and I'm like, great, no thanks. Can we talk about the real stuff? And I think that JP's writing and talking and work on it is bringing a new life to what should it be and how should it matter in business.
Do you get the sense that there is a growing awareness of strategy as something that people need to take seriously and do well? And of course, you guys are doing your part to do that. Mm-hmm. Where do you think strategy is in its life cycle and its market adoption, if you will?
Oh, that's a very good question. I like it. It depends on who you ask, right? And everyone likes to believe that their particular brand of strategy is sort of hitting the early majority, it feels like, at the moment. I think we're starting to see a shift away from the traditional strategic planning modes, and because we had business process for engineering in the 80s, and now we're sort of shifting towards something else. But I think we're probably stuck with the current phase for a bit longer, because paradigm shifts don't tend to happen until sort of the behemoths die out, which basically means that we have certain companies that need to fail, and we have certain thinkers that need to, how to put it delicately, stop thinking.
At least stop publishing.
Yeah. But I mean, like, I think we're heading in the right direction. Now, whether we're heading in the right direction at the right speed is perhaps up for debate, but I see progress.
Well, I think we're seeing right now, too, a better and better understanding that when you take strategy and combine it with strategic planning, which is a lot of companies imply the two together, I think, so that when they say strategy, they're talking about a very formal, kind of rigid process of planning, that still is out there and still dominating, even though it's been around for 20 or 30 years. But we're beginning to get more and more research that shows that that planning process impedes progress often as much as or more than it helps. And there's lots of stories about disasters that have come through that process. And I think the more those come out and are well known, people will look for new ways to approach strategy like JP's bringing us.
Yeah. I mean, I can talk at length about why plans fail, right? But the way that most companies use them in practice, feels like to me anyway, is to have like laundry lists of goals. So if you work in manufacturing, you have one plan, and then you work in marketing, you have another plan. And if you work in sales, you have a third plan, and there's no synchronization between them. And so you end up with, even if you do manage to get some positive results, it's just positive for whoever came up with them, not the actual organization as a whole. And that's a huge problem when people conflate strategy with planning.
One thing I wanted to get your take on was the relationship between marketing and strategy. You could certainly make a case that strategy marketing like are the same. And you could also make a case that strategy is a much wider thing and marketing just does its part. And there was news articles about like DOJ and Apple, and you could say, hey, there's like a marketing problem, or is it a strategy problem? Can we speak to like that and what your take is on it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that marketing in a broad sense, speaking of marketing as the full four P's, which it isn't these days, but for the sake of the argument, I think if that's your view of marketing, then I think marketing will always be a part of a broader strategic conversation. If you just reduce marketing to comms, then I think you have an issue. But let's, for the sake of the argument, let's say that it's the full four P's. Now, within that, you have product, obviously. And I think the Apple problem is one that we've seen quite a few times before, whereby you get to a point where it's the wet dream of conventional strategic planning, right? Conventional strategy, which is that you achieve a monopoly. And then what tends to happen is that you get really good at defending your position for various reasons, because you can, you have such power within the market, but actually you lose innovative capacities and capabilities. And I think that's what we're seeing with Apple at the moment, because God knows their innovation of late hasn't been that impressive. Dog, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I would concur on Apple. First of all, I see them as still living off of the innovations from the past and cashing them in. It's the cash cow for them. And their newer innovations have been technically pretty, some of them have been technically striking. But as far as customers, I haven't seen them be as valuable to customers. But that's my sense of it. I think you're right that, you know, I mean, some of this is what you're describing, which is everybody would really love to have a monopoly market if they could get there at some level. But also, I think there's another element that's entered, and I think somewhat it's entered with digitization and with digital people like Apple or eBay or Google or Amazon, which is this increasing returns, as pointed out by Brian Arthur in Complexity, which is that when you're in a market where there's a tremendous amount based on knowledge and achievement, once a company reaches a certain size or domination in the market, it becomes ever increasingly harder for anybody to unseat them. And I think that's a little bit what I actually think is missing from U.S. antitrust understanding, is that this is a thing that happens, but that a lot of the law is based on these ideas like, well, if there's low prices, it must not be an abuse of power. And I don't agree with that. I think if we want healthy markets, we want a wide range of prices and we want a lot of those things. And there's these other issues that bring into abuse of power, because I think you could take that increasing returns and say, why is Google so hard to challenge? Well, they reached an increasing returns point where it's over a hump. It almost nobody could ever really seriously challenge them. Facebook, same thing. Amazon, same thing. I suppose so with Apple, although I have questions about this antitrust suit. So
part of that problem, of course, is that price is so easily measurable and quality isn't. So you just standardize on price and you miss a bunch of variables and values as a result. Mm-hmm. And you're right, that absolutely is the case. But is this a marketing problem or a strategy problem?
For the company, I think it's both. They go hand in hand. You can't do a company strategy without a thorough look at marketing with whatever we want to call it, a big M or little M. The truth of the four Ps, whether they're in your marketing department or not, you've got to deal with all of the four Ps. They influence and adapt and change around whatever strategy you pick as a company. So they have to be very integral to it. I don't see it. It's hard for me to separate them and say, well, we got a marketing strategy. And I think we have good ideas about marketing, but what's our corporate strategy has to be the dominant factor, because how we approach our marketing work has to influence it. I don't know, JP, what's your thought?
I would agree. I think the other thing, though, that I would add is that most strategies do not take into account the company's own success, if that makes sense, right? That's never considered in the strategy process. And so what tends to happen, and this has to do with complexity and adaptive systems in general, but it is that the more successful you are, the more confident you are in your knowledge, the more you tend to discount change and signals and anomalies and whatever else, so you can become trapped within your own strategy, if that makes sense.
When you say didn't take into account, I'm not sure. That struck me as one of those like, wait, what? But I know you. I know what you're saying. You've got some really good thought underneath. So maybe explain a bit more, because I'm still circling around it.
Yeah. So if you're talking about things like the implications of having a monopoly position in the market, of complacency, the problems that come with success. I mean, traditional strategy tends to be you apply resources over time to achieve change. And then ideally, you get to a point where magically all your problems have been solved. What you don't consider is that situation, that place in and of itself could be a problem. Right. Uh-huh. I made a point of before of saying that strategy ultimately is about movement. Right. Uh-huh. In my world of adaptive strategy, you want to move in a certain direction at the right speed and tempo. But strategic planning and conventional strategy is always concerned with getting a certain point, which implies the cessation of movement. You stop. Uh-huh. But if you stop, you're dead. So there are things like that. There are dynamics within strategy. I mean, there are meta problems, if we're honest. But nonetheless, you don't factor in your own success, so to speak. Yeah. And everything that comes out of that.
So there are no destinations. Just rest areas.
Yeah, no, I mean, my co-author for the new book, Steve, he likes to call it the Garden of Eden strategy, which we get to a point where magically we're in paradise and all the problems have been solved and then there are competitors and no issues and this, that, and the other. But that never, ever happens in practice. So it's a bit silly to sort of suggest that it does.
So tell us a bit more about the book. What's it about? What can you share at this point?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so the book is called What to Do When You Don't Know What to Do, and it's on adaptive strategy, you know, in sort of a current world of uncertainty. And there are three parts to the book. We've sort of mentioned them in a couple of webinars. But the first part of the book is everything that got us to this point, going back in history to Newton and Walras and Laplace and that kind of the core ideas of neoclassical economic theory into strategic management theory with people like Taylor and then later Drucker and whatever else, and how these ideas and assumptions have sort of permeated throughout history and gotten us to the point where we're at the moment. And that point that we're at the moment is that a lot of strategies fail, or most fail, and all plans eventually fail. And so we talk about, okay, so what are the manifestations of all of this? That's the second part of the book. And then the last big thing is, okay, so what do we do about it? And we're very clear on it. We basically go, so if you just want to work with adaptive strategy and sort of run the exercise and build this kind of strategy and use the ABCD framework and whatever else, just read that part of the book. But if you want to teach it, if you want to work within it as a consultant, then you need the theory. So I suppose in a way, the book is also about that idea of praxis, theory and the histrionics and whatever else. And then, okay, so what do we do about it in practice? So that's the idea. And it's a very hands-on, pragmatic, you can pick it up and start working with the kind of book. It's not that, Doug and I, we speak every fortnight or so. Our view, and you know, I hope I'm not speaking out of turn here, I'm putting words in your mouth, but our view is that most business books are a 10-page idea stretching to 300 pages, right? And there are reasons why you do that. And that's typically because you don't make any money off the book. You make money off of the keynote speeches that follow, and then and mm-hmm. the 10 pages work quite well as a keynote. Our book is not like that at all. It's just like every chapter could be its own book and then some. So it's quite heavy on information. But again, nonetheless, it's pick it up, do the thing, and it's very practical and has all the mm-hmm. exercises and all the frameworks and blah, blah, blah.
I think that's the irony of people's assumption about business books is they expect it to be these simple kind of checklists. Like yeah. you come out of the book with six things to do. But my experience is there's a lot that people can do from just simply being informed, understanding, seeing examples of what other people have done, and essentially put them in a position to be real managers, which is to look at what's around them and make choices, because that's what we're good at for managers.
Yeah.
And I think that's it's interesting to be around the book industry right now, because there are publishers who understand that, and there's publishers who are so committed to the 6 points coming out of the book, or the 7 habits, whichever you prefer, exactly. that you really don't get. I mean, I think we're in a place where the business writing is impoverished today, because it really hasn't been. We haven't been saying things. And I mean, I'm a scholarly type, and I will tell you, I have rarely read a business book that I found stimulating and interesting that deals with the reality that I had to work with. Mm-hmm. And that's a shame. That seems a crime against humanity or the economy, one of the two.
So we talked about Apple, DOJ. They're missing some things. But they certainly missed the boat, by the way, on AI.
And
they're like trying to catch up. And that's like inexcusable in some ways. Mm. But they also have a lot of money in the bank, so they can buy their way back into it, perhaps. But there was also news on Amazon. And there was a topic that seemed worthy. Do you want to tell us what they did, Doug, and what your take is?
Yeah, so Amazon, we are in the middle of the Amazon spring sale. And it's actually striking that they did this, because for a long time, Amazon had Prime Day, and that was the only thing we saw from them, is they would have one event. Well, apparently that's become so popular. I believe this is their third event now this year. So they're now planning instead of one event a year. And essentially, it's a discounters event, which is they try to draw a whole bunch of people in with promise of low prices and create a feeding frenzy at Amazon to drive a ton of sales, in theory. Of course, there's a lot to be fearful of in that, which is discounting means giving up profit. And there's some ways I look at this as, how fast can you pay people to take your product? Weak. I mean, I'm not sure that's entirely fair, but I think there's an aspect to it. But that's what's going on, is they have a big week of sales, but very much like Prime Day and some of the other things they've done. It's a little concerning, because this is the kind of stuff you don't expect to see from Amazon. And my first question was, who has to make their metrics? Because it has the feel of somebody has a metric somewhere that says, oh, you know what? We got to have this much this year. And they run around, they're like, you know what? If our revenue metric needs to be that, we'll do another sale. That'll get us there, which, of course, may not be very healthy for the company.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, one of the things that I see a lot with retailers is that they become addicted to discounts. And part of it is the revenue stuff. But also what tends to happen when you run these kinds of sales is you effectively pull purchase up in time, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you bought a new lawnmower at a discount, you're not going to buy another one 2 weeks later just because that's when you thought you'd buy the thing.
Right.
But I think in terms of Amazon, I mean, I have a slightly different view on it. And I think perhaps this ties back to the Apple example and market manipulation in a way. But so if we just do the basic maths for these kinds of things, right? So to your point, when you, as everyone knows, right, if you lower the price, you need to make it up somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So if you look at retail, and again, I don't have the figures for Amazon, to take this with a grain of salt, but if you look at retail, right, the average price elasticity is around minus 2.6. So what this means is, in translation, is that if you lower your price by 10%, right, you should stimulate a volume increase of around 26% on average. And this can go higher if you actually announce the sale, statistically speaking. So if you say we're going to have a huge sale, you can get a price elasticity upwards of minus 5, which basically means that a 10% cut leads to a 50% increase in volume. Now, what you have to do, again, is you have to factor in the current margin, right? So the theory goes, the reasoning around these kinds of events is, if your gross margin is, let's say, 30%, you have to sell 50% more to break even at a 10% discount, right? So if the margin is, say, 20%, and you lower your prices by 10%, you have to sell 100% more to break even. And so at this point, people go, okay, so if you think about the price elasticity and this thing over here, this is how much we need to make in order to make up, you know, our margins and whatever else. And you see this with financial analysts all the time. But what you don't think about is the fact that, again, you need to factor in your entire baseline sales, because all of your sales of that thing will come at a discount. So the actual cost on your margins tends to be a lot higher. Okay, so what does this mean for Amazon? Well, if you look at their Q3 figures, right, they were, I think net income was $13.2 billion. Okay, I think most of us would be happy with that. But we also know that making money off of e-com is very difficult. Not to sort of reference my own work too much, but in a white paper that I wrote in 2021 with James Hankins, we could establish that the higher your penetration online, the lower your profit margin is as a rule. And there are reasons why that is that we can go into if we're interested, but nonetheless, that's the rule. Right. Okay. So if we start looking at the figures, right? So in the same quarter, Amazon Web Services, AWS, their revenue was $24.2 billion, a margin roughly 30%, according to the financials. So the net income is $7.2 billion. Then they have the advertising business, which came at $14.7 billion revenue. Now, I worked in ad tech quite a bit, especially early on when I did consultancies, but also in retail media of late. And so retail media gross margin tends to be 70-90%. And so I would estimate that the net margin for Amazon on their advertising business is probably somewhere between 60-80%. Let's say 60, let's be conservative. So that equals a net income of $8.82 billion. In other words, if you subtract it, what you discover is that Amazon was $2.82 billion in the red from the retail side, right? So actually, their figures weren't that great. But, and here's the kicker, Amazon can afford it. So there is a potential point of running these kinds of promotions because it pulls everyone else into a price war, effectively playing a game that Amazon is much better at. So they can effectively, because, I mean, we're talking about competition and price and whatever else. And the fact of the matter is that by lowering your prices, you can fuck up the market just as well. Mm-hmm. So it might be, even though it looks like a short-term play, it could, and I'm not saying it is, because again, I don't have the insight, but it could potentially be a long-term play where you undermine competition by essentially running sales that they just cannot match.
Mm-hmm. The question about abuse of power, that all this is worth going back to, because I've maintained at some level, this is what Amazon has done with the retail-like portion of their market since the beginning. Mm. That initially they negotiated long payment terms with suppliers, which gave them lots of free cash, which is part of why we were focused on cash flow, because that let them lose all kinds of money. But the cash flow, and as long as they continued to grow, cash flow was always a good thing. They would always be cash flow positive because each quarter they were getting more and more revenue. As long as that kept happening, then they were able to bootstrap themselves up with outrageously low prices, and their investors were getting returns because the stock went up, not because the company was a strong company in the market, in a sense. And so I published a blog post a few years ago pondering whether Amazon had been abusing power from the beginning, but escaped prosecution because they used low prices to do it. And takes us back to fundamental in the Department of Justice, low price equals healthy market.
Yeah.
And I think that one's worth talking about because the more I work, the more I think that the low price market is a market that's dying. Once you reach a point where prices are always low, the market's either a commodity market like fuel oil or gas or electricity, or it's a dying market because nobody wants it. And there's not enough activity to drive significant investment and interest in the market. And so I think that this idea of low is wrong. One last thought on that is, okay, so where did that come from? It comes from traditional economics, which are based on commodity. So all the traditional economic equations are entropy equations from physics, I believe, that assume fundamentally that you've got only so much and that it's got to decay to a best price. And that best price has to be low. And while that's true in commodities, it's not true many other places. And that's a problem with U.S. antitrust law, is that it started with the right idea, which is prevent abuses of power, but has been sidetracked into some specific ways of defining that.
Why is it the case in commodities? Because quality is pretty fixed and like it is what it is.
Yeah, I think if quality is pretty fixed and you've got just got people competing with the fundamentally the same quality product, there's a natural way that it levels out through arbitrage or whatever the fancy word is we want to put on it. And JP's probably going to correct me a bunch here because he's looked at this a bit more than I have. But anyway, that's my fundamental sense of it is, yeah, that's the fundamental equations. And then you've got people coming out of complexity in economics. Everybody shakes their head and goes, oh my God, it's a problem, because sometimes that's true and a lot of times it's not.
Yeah. But the other thing that comes across to me as I hear you guys talk about the finances and the complexity of like managing those numbers, etc., is really the importance of what you were saying, Doug, a couple episodes ago on how marketing and mathematics and finance really are pretty well blended. So really the advice to all the marketing practitioners who might listen to this is like, don't be afraid of numbers. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid of equations. Just like delve in and it'll really make you a better marketing person. Mm-hmm. Because at the end, it really is about the kind of analysis that we just heard you guys provide with the margins and the competitiveness. And it's like the complexity is real.
So. Well, in that sense, I mean, the trick I have is I'm a curmudgeon when it comes to metrics because they get abused so badly. But that's when they're used as goals, right? The minute a number becomes a goal, it has changed considerably. But in fact, numbers are give us tremendous power to understand what can help us understand what's going on, give us the ability to help other people see it. There's a lot of value to them. It's just we also abuse them in business a lot. So
that's right. If it's measured, it's gamed.
Yeah.
That was the rule. Absolutely. Yeah.
So do you want to correct my economics at all, JP, or enlighten on them? Elaborate.
No. I mean, I think you're broadly speaking correct. But I mean, my caveat would be that most of the, at least neoclassical economic theories, they do come out of physics, right? You can trace it back to Newton and Laplace and a couple others. Mm-hmm. But you end up with calculations that are not necessarily representative of the actual world, right? So if you take, for example, Aaron de Bruce, twice Nobel Prize winning theory of general competitive equilibrium, it's all calculations and numbers and very fancy maths, and it's all very tidy and beautiful, but they make sort of fundamental assumptions that just don't hold up. For example, the ability to pre-state all dated continued goods. That means in sort of plain language is that they think that they can pre-state what the price of a bushel of wheat on a Wednesday in Oregon when it rains a week after the Boston Red Sox have won the World Series. Well, that will be 100 years in advance. And you go, well, if you go back 100 years and then some, what is the likelihood that someone would have been able to predict the price of a secondhand iPhone on eBay? It's just they wouldn't. It's literally impossible, right? You can go into reasons why Kaufman's theory of the idea is impossible and whatever else. But what we have to remember when we use formulas and numbers and whatever else is that they represent reality. They're not reality itself, if that makes sense. And as long as we do that, I think we're fine. But to your point as well, Shane, is that one of the things I really didn't like when I was in law school was this incessant that lawyers were somehow bad with numbers. And for me, that was weird because I'd studied at the Swedish equivalent of the MIT. So I'd done theoretical maths and stuff, right? And so I found that's like provocative. But I think the same is true that Marcus, the self-defeating, slightly I suppose, self-fulfilling prophecy. They go, well, we don't understand numbers, or we have KPIs, but you know, and then you end up with all kinds of platitudes and bad calculations, and they don't understand the basics of business strategy or how you calculate the stuff that I mentioned, your margin, for example. And then what then ends up happening is that marketing isn't taken seriously by the rest of the organization. And so you need to be mathematically, you need to have some sort of baseline training, I think, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you want a seat at the table, you need to qualify to have the seat at the table. Yeah.
I wanted to come back a little bit, if we can, to something that's been circulating here since the beginning of our conversation, but we haven't called out, which is that a fundamental reality in a complex situation is we cannot predict the future.
Yeah.
And if you sit down and look at business planning is all predicated on the idea we can predict the future. Well, we do A, then B happens, then we do B and C happens. And then, then we may have it might split into two options at that point. But there's a lot of idea behind it that we can see a very long way down the road. And that having seen that way, we can plot out how to get from here to there as if on a map. When in reality, as we do business, a tremendous amount of what is going to happen remains hidden in the fog of doing business. And a great deal of what does happen can even be accidental. I mean, I was looking the other day, I was doing some writing on hiring people. And the reality that when we go out to hire, at any point in time that a company goes out to hire, no more than maybe 5 to 10% of the people that might fit a position will be available. And so the company is inherently starts with a limitation, and it's accidental which ones are available and which ones aren't. And the company can take steps to try to groom and attract, but the reality is it's an accident who's actually interviewing and who's actually there. And as companies, we make wise choices with that, but we can't deny the accidental part of what happens in
the randomness.
The randomness, and it's there, and I know that would probably, I could probably get vilified for this at the right business meeting, but fundamentally, there's a lot that you can't predict. And I think in what JP was talking about with strategy and strategic planning, that's one of the problems in strategic planning, is it assumes we can know what's going to happen with the price of a bushel of wheat after the Celtics win a game in Oregon on a rainy Monday. Well, obviously you can't. Statistics help us somewhat because they wash out little bits of noise and help us get some steadiness. Yeah. But not everything works in a way that statistics are effective. There's a lot of unusual things that happen that you can't predict that way. So I think it's an important part out of complexity. And JP and I have talked quite a bit about this challenge.
That's excellent. Let's talk about strategy and change.
In the known universe, there are two fundamental laws, right? Well, there are three, if you count the fact that it doesn't matter how good you are at something, there will always be a 12-year-old Japanese girl who can do it better. But beyond that, right, you're looking at two fundamental laws. And the fundamental laws are as follows. The first one is that there will always be, resources will always be finite. So the law of finite resources. It doesn't matter how successful or rich or whatever you are, there will always be finite resources. And the other law is the law of continuous change. So the world that we live in is one of perpetual change, right? Always has been, always will be. And so the key to strategy to I suppose life in a way, is balancing these two things. And the problem is that they're not necessarily linearly linked, and there are a bunch of trade-offs between them. So if we become really good at managing finite resources, in other words, we become efficient, right? Mm-hmm. That means we lose our ability to adapt. Mm-hmm. And we see this all the time in complexity and nature. I mean, if you take Rory has one of his favorite examples is the beehive, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and maybe your listeners are too. But for those who aren't, basically bees communicate via what's called a waggle dance. They shake their tails a bit, and that tells the other bees where they can find food. But about 20% of bees completely ignore this. And this used to drive bee researchers insane, because they thought over the 20 odd million years that bees have been around, there would have evolved what one might call bee compliance officers that ensure that the people stuck to the plan and there's enough nectar collected for the Q3 forecast. But they just do something completely different. And the reason why, of course, is that if we just focus on the food that we know where it is, right? If we become efficient, essentially, if we optimize the process, then if there's a surprise, something happens to that source, we are fucked. So we need people who go out and do the other stuff. However, having said that, if all the bees go out at random, they won't be able to bring back enough food to sustain the hive, right? So in other words, if we put all our money into efficiency, right, we'll become brittle and we won't be able to adapt. If something happens, we're fucked. But if we put all our money into adaptation, we won't have enough resources.
So again, it'll be different.
Exactly. So you need to balance those two things. And I think that's going back to this idea of adaptive strategy. I think I'm talking about adaptive strategy from a very personal sort of philosophical standpoint. It's the view of strategy that I have and Steve has with my co-author, Steve McCrone. But it's adaptive strategy is about balancing those two things. It's not the agile at scale and experimentation, and not strategic planning, and we're just going to do this and all about efficiency. Yes, again, it's about the balance.
Yeah, that's right on, right on. One thing I have experienced this was you're running a marketing department and you're super efficient because you don't have a lot of resources, not have enough budget, enough staff. So everything is just so, but then you lose resilience. It's like an engine that has no provision for anything going wrong. Yeah, and then the moment something goes wrong, then you're like totally hosed.
Yeah, I mean, a good example of this, sorry to interrupt, but were any of you guys traveling, was it 2022, Christmas 2022?
I did.
Were you flying Southwest?
Oh, no, I heard about that. I remember that. Yes.
Yeah. So for those who aren't familiar with the story, what happened was there was surprise in the form of weather change, right? So the weather's really bad. And as a result, the computer system that Southwest Airlines was using to synchronize all the various workers, that just broke down. Uh-huh. And as a result, people were stranded and it ended up costing the company upwards of $1.2 billion. Uh-huh. And the conclusion that many people have drawn from this is that, it was because the system was old. And yes, it was, but that's not the problem. The problem was that it was because of the finite nature of resources and the brittleness of systems. You're talking about a system with endpoints, with sort of, you have your competence envelope and then something happens outside of that. And all kinds of reliable systems eventually fail. It's the idea of if you have had a newer system, then I might have been able to handle that thing. But if something worse had come along, there's no guarantee that would have worked, and so on and so forth. One of the examples that I use the most that I think a lot of people are familiar with is the Fukushima disaster. But basically, they had the seawall, along came a big wave, and they went, oh, okay, so we need to increase the level of the seawall so that we can withstand the highest waves that have been. And then another higher wave comes along, and then we get the Fukushima disaster. So all of these kinds of systems have breaking points. To your point, we need to sort of understand that these exist, and we need to increase resilience, and we need to do mitigation and all kinds of things so that, and I think going back to Amazon, I think that this is what they do really well. They can lose money in their e-com thing, but they make money in total from all the other stuff. Most companies don't have the other stuff, so they just lose money on the e-com bit, and then eventually they die. They don't become Amazon, if that makes sense.
Yeah, right on.
I think I wanted to jump in too, because I think there's another example that many of our listeners might have run into is around stuff like Google. Because one of the hidden brittlenesses in marketing is the degree to which we all become dependent on these vendors like Google, Meta, the places we're buying our advertising or getting the bulk of our business through. I had a client who was getting about 25% of their business from one referral source. Yeah. And on a day, Amazon reclassified them as a bad place, not a good place. And he lost 25% of his business overnight.
Yeah.
And that was a hidden thing. And I think that's one of the weird things in the internet marketing world, is there are some hidden dependencies that we do not have control over and that can bite us and that require that we think about how to be more able to be resilient. We've seen it on Amazon where they've stopped emphasizing small players, which was their start. And I've heard from a lot of people who are, you know, frustrated with that because they based their entire business strategy around Amazon, and Amazon changes its strategy. And when you're up against somebody of that size, you don't have any ability to influence it. So you've got, and so they bring these weird resiliences. So it doesn't even have to be the natural disaster like a Fukushima, which absolutely those will happen. But even some of the things that happen, we assume the system is going to keep working the way it works. But these tech companies, for example, have the ability to say, no, I'm changing my policy. We're prioritizing search different, or whatever it is. And I hear a lot of stories from people about how they've been hurt by those things. Not quite as bad as my client that lost 25% of his business overnight.
I think that's a rule that is sort of widely applicable, if you will. If you apply to, for example, automation, which is the big thing at the moment with the rise of AI, the idea is, so if you take retail, for example, right? So you automate your warehouse logistics processes, for example, right? The idea is you automate the manual processes. Okay, so that makes us more efficient. However, we can't really trust these systems full out because, again, they fail. So we'd still need manual processes. We still need maintenance, upskilling, updates. But then you have to start thinking about, exactly to your point, do we just use the one system, essentially putting all our eggs into a basket owned by someone else? Or do we use many systems and then risk them not being able to speak to one another? And not only that, but what we see is what Hankis and I call value chain vampires. So you have all of these various apps and tools and whatever else that individually claim to increase efficiency. But when you add them all together, it comes at a surplus cost. And so, again, I think that kind of, all those kinds of dependencies are the idea, the rule, if you will, is applicable across the board pretty much.
Yeah. So could do a cartoon, which we didn't do up front.
Well, I always like ending with at least a little bit of current lightness. So,
or we could averageize and do something else.
Well, seeing that we've gone a bit longer than we ordinarily do, because it's been really fun to talk to JP, maybe we should tune it. What do you think? Tune it?
All right. Let's do that.
Okay. All right.
So we didn't do a cartoon up front. We're going to do it at the end. What is in the cart?
The cartoon of the week has a board-like meeting. Everybody looking formal, dressed nicely, sitting around a table. And yes, there's a woman in the crowd, so it's a modern cartoon. Good. Thank you. God, we had too many years without. So anyway. And the comment is, we need to develop a long-term strategy to achieve consistent, quick fixes. And I think I'll leave it there and let you guys visit. Oh, actually, I will say my first thought was it lays out one of the classic quandaries about quick and strategy of can strategy work quickly, but there's a lot more interesting to it as we dig into it.
So my reaction was that it sounds like it's like a dumb comment that it shouldn't be made. Mm-hmm. But then my view was that, well, hang on a second, maybe that's not a bad request. Maybe mm-hmm. we do need a strategy that gives us that sort of agility. Mm-hmm. But now, JP, since, again, you live this sort of stuff, what is your take?
I mean, my take on it is similar to yours. I don't think it's a bad idea at all. Because if you work with a proper adaptive strategy, you're not necessarily bound by time. And what I mean by that is, again, adaptive strategy is about a shared understanding of success and whether we're heading in the right direction at the right speed. And time doesn't necessarily factor into that. The reason why I think time factors so heavily into strategic planning is, I think, partly it's because people want to make sure that are we actually fulfilling or hitting our goals or whatever else. But I think a large part is also because it creates recurring revenue for the consultant. But again, if you have this idea of movement, then you can do what Dave Snowden calls, you can adhere to the frozen two rule, which is to do the next right thing, right? Mm-hmm. So you can do the quick fixes, provided that they're coherent to the overall direction. And the intention is, okay, so are we moving in? Does this move us in the right direction at the right speed? If you do that, then I think you're fine. The problem with not doing that is you ignore all the small problems, and then eventually something big happens and you're screwed. Mm-hmm. And maybe that summarized the entire podcast in this idea of robustness versus resilience and planning mm-hmm. versus adaptation and so on and so forth.
Yeah, that's excellent. Excellent. And as you know from our pre-call email exchange, I thought this episode would be, so why does this not work in praxis?
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
Excellent. So shall we conclude, gentlemen?
I think that seems reasonable.
Yeah.
All right. So thank you, Doug. JP, thank you for your time. I know with the time difference, it's like pushing late evening on a Friday. Really grateful for your time as always. Such a delight.
Oh, thank you. It's been absolutely my pleasure. And hopefully I'll be able to come back sometime in the future.
All right. Excellent. So once again, a reminder, the website is jpcastlin.com. Go check it out, as well as the newsletter, Strategy and Praxis. And with that, thank you all for listening. Thank you, JP. Thank you, Doug. Until next time.
Thanks, Shane.
That's it for this episode of the Marketing Podcast. Every episode is posted on orionx.net and shared on social media. Use the comments section or tweet us with any questions or to propose topics. If you like the show, rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Marketing Podcast is a production of OrionX. Thank you for listening.